He may have had a bad back, but he had a spine of steel.
If there's a strike on Iraq, we're going to have a very, very large, widespread, and rapidly growing movement on the streets.
Hypocrisy is one of the coins of the realm in politics.
For every fall of a dollar in the price of a barrel of oil, Iraq lost $1 billion in income.
A casualty-rich war in the post-Vietnam era is simply politically unacceptable.
Music and the arts are just vital to the social movement.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, October 30th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Former Vice President Walter Mondale, who served under President Jimmy Carter, gave Democrats the answer they were looking for today, saying he will run for Senate in place of the late Senator Paul Wellstone. In a letter to the state Democratic Party, Mondale wrote, "It is with a heavy heart but a great hope for the future that I will pick up the campaign where Paul Wellstone left off." Wellstone was killed in a plane crash Friday in northern Minnesota in the midst of a tough reelection battle with Republican Norm Coleman, a former mayor of St. Paul. The race is one of several that could determine control of the U.S. Senate, which Wellstone's death left split 49-49 with one independent who sides with the Democrats. Wellstone's son, David, asked Mondale on Saturday to make the run, saying his father would have wanted it. But Mondale deferred an announcement until after last night's memorial service for Wellstone. Mark Wellstone remembered his father's favorite phrase to a crowd of over 20,000 who crammed into the Williams Arena at the University of Minnesota.
These are some of his favorite words that he ever spoke. I truly believe that he's very, very proud of these words. The words he spoke were, "Never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. Never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. We will carry on the fight. We will carry on the struggle. We will carry on the tradition. We will carry on the pride. We will carry on the struggle. And we will carry on the legacy. And we will do it for Paul. And I'll tell you what, Mom, you're right. We will win. 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 Thank you, Mom and Dad and Marcia. We love you. Thank you."
Wellstone often referred to himself as the champion for the little feller, as opposed to the Rockefellers, and it was the people who turned out in droves for a spirited rally-like memorial. Former President Bill Clinton, former Vice President Al Gore, and many members of Congress were among the last to take their seats. U.S. Senator Tom Harkin, a Democrat from Ohio, a close friend of Wellstone's, gave a fighting wave to the crowd as he walked to take his seat. He spoke of a story Wellstone loved to repeat.
He loved telling one story that I heard a lot. It was one of his early speeches, and he thought it was a rather eloquent and passionate speech. You can read about it in his book, The Conscience of a Liberal. He got through with his speech, and a senior senator, Senator Hollings of South Carolina, approached him and said, "Young man, you remind me of Hubert Humphrey." Paul swelled with pride, and then Senator Hollings added, "You talk too much." Paul would tell this story time and time again. And he'd get that punchline, and he'd squint that eye, and that eyebrow would go up, and that smile would be from ear to ear, and he'd laugh at that joke on himself. Well, Paul may have talked a lot, but he meant every word. He showed us that the way to lead is by following your conscience. And when injustice reared its head, or when unfairness seemed the norm, or selfishness was being rewarded, Paul would go into battle, and he didn't care if he was the only one. He may have had a bad back, but he had a spine of steel.
U.S. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. Pacifica National Affairs and political analyst Larry Bensky says there's nobody else in the U.S. Senate right now of either party who has the kind of tie to people that Paul Wellstone had. Bensky says the late Senator Wellstone's vote against Bush's war resolution probably would not have been the political albatross some suspected it would be.
I think for Senator Wellstone, being one of the most principled people that's ever served in the Senate, it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to vote against any kind of war resolution that President Bush wanted, because Paul Wellstone voted in a principled manner. Having said that, I don't think it was an especially courageous vote on his part. I don't think it hurt him with the people of Minnesota. I think if he had voted for the Iraq resolution, it would have been so out of character for him that it would have completely alienated his base and probably cost him the election. So some commentators have said, oh, he might have cost himself the election by voting against President Bush's Iraq war resolution. I don't see that at all. I think what he did is he solidified his standing in Minnesota by being so forthright and so consistent with his principles. On the other hand, of course, Senator Wellstone did vote for military action in Afghanistan. And I think the experience he had hearing from people in his constituency who were outraged about that further served to solidify his stand against the Bush administration's request for their blank check resolution, which, of course, they eventually got about Iraq.
Senator Mondale is 74 years old, and the Republicans have promised to make his age an issue in this campaign. He's going up against Republican Norm Coleman, a much younger man. How do you think that's going to play out in the final analysis?
Well, hypocrisy is one of the coins of the realm in politics, and for the Republicans now to make Walter Mondale's issue an age when they haven't said boo about the semi-senile or actually totally senile presences of Jesse Helms and Strom Thurmond in the United States Senate for years.
And it's also President Reagan when he ran against Mondale.
Right, and President Reagan's notorious memory lapses in his final years in office. So sure, the Republicans may try to make an issue of that. Mondale seems to be quite a vigorous person. 74 is not a super advanced age in this day and age in which we live, and I don't think that'll fly with people. There are plenty of people in Minnesota who've seen and will see Walter Mondale in action and realize that the man is in excellent health and excellent mental and physical health for a person of his age. And if he finishes his Senate term at the age of 80, that's not very old anymore either.
Aside from the age difference or discrepancy, what are the political differences between Republican Norm Coleman and Walter Mondale?
Oh, I think we haven't seen Mondale defining himself, of course, in this campaign yet. He's going to have very little chance to do so. And ironically, Verna, the idea of what their positions being different is not even going to be an issue. It isn't an issue in a lot of races because everything is fought on image and irrelevant mudslinging in television ads. But less so than ever when a person has, 5 days to run for office, there isn't going to be time to define somebody as far as issues are concerned. What's important about Walter Mondale right now is he has the gravitas and the experience and the knowledge and the spirit to be a Democratic Party candidate for Senate. Coleman's positions were very different from Wellstone's, on Iraq, for example, on backing President Bush's war proclivities, on a privatization of Social Security, on many, many issues, where Coleman, who formerly was a Democrat and switched to being a Republican so he could run for higher office in Minnesota, took stands that he believed in that were very different from Wellstone's. I don't think that the issues are going to be voted on now. You've got a tremendous emotional component going in Minnesota, and you also have a tremendous political component. We're not only in Minnesota, but in Missouri and Colorado and New Hampshire and other states where the Senate races are close, voters' attention has been focused by Paul Wellstone's death on something that had not been receiving attention sufficiently beforehand, and that is the very narrowness by which the Democrats continue to control one House of Congress. Should the Republicans win control of the Senate and maintain control of the House and have the lock they now have on the judiciary in the White House, you've got a Republican steamroller for all the policies that people say in polling they don't want. They don't want further tax cuts for the rich. They don't want privatization of Social Security. They don't want further erosion of medical care in this country. They don't want so many things that the Republicans and the terrible environmental practices that the Bush administration tries to promote. People seem to not want that. On the other hand, they have a very, very narrow defense against it, which is the control of one of the houses of Congress, not even by a big margin, not by a filibuster-proof majority, but by the Democrats. If you focus people's attention on that in these close races, I think you can see the momentum shift to the Democrats as Election Day approaches. It's a big factor in Minnesota, and I think it's going to leak over into other states as well.
So that's the risk. And do we know the exact numbers as to how many seats the Democrats need in order to hang on to the Senate?
Well, they need to win. Of the seats at stake, there are about half a dozen, and the Democrats that are competitive. And the Democrats really need to take three or four of them to keep a one-vote majority. It keeps shifting all the time. Now we hear that Georgia's in play. There's a possibility that it may not be as close in a few other states as we thought it was. But the Democrats need to take, I would say, four out of six states. When you look at Minnesota, when you look at South Dakota, New Hampshire, Colorado, and Arkansas, and Georgia, the Democrats have to take four of those six states, I would say, to maintain control, because they may lose a couple of states as well.
And you say Minnesota is a lock.
I wouldn't call it a lock, but ironically and sadly, I think it's in better shape for the Democrats it was now than it was before Senator Wellstone's tragic death.
Pacifica National Affairs and political analyst Larry Binsky. A poll in Wednesday's Minneapolis Star Tribune showed Mondale's leading Coleman 47% to 39%, similar to Wellstone's lead before his death.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned?
Some analysts have made comparisons in recent months between the war in Vietnam and what they fear could happen if a new war is launched on Iraq. And along with references to Vietnam come memories of the military draft and the fear that it could one day come back to haunt us. But how likely is it that the draft could be reinstated? And what alternative options would peace-loving Americans have? We asked those questions earlier today to Bill Galvin, counseling coordinator for the Center for Conscience and War. Also joining the conversation was Tom Cornell, associate editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper and longtime counselor for draft resistors. The draft. Gentlemen, do we even dare mention the word draft in this current hawkish climate of the Bush administration?
Dare mention it? Well, we'd better mention it because it's a real possibility.
Bill Galvin.
I would agree with Tom. It's a very real possibility. I think there's no doubt they would like to avoid a draft if they could. They have enough trouble dealing with the people who supposedly volunteer for the military. But the reality is that the numbers just don't add up. That if there is going to be a major ground war in Iraq, And not to mention about a dozen other countries around the world that Rumsfeld has indicated the U.S. should invade. The numbers don't add up. They're not going to have the people. Rumsfeld has already acknowledged that the troops are getting stretched thin. And so, you know, they're going to have to get people somehow, and the draft seems like a very real possibility.
So throughout the history of this country, every time there is a need for troops, a draft is reinstated?
Oh, sure. Since the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that has been the pattern. And even though the government is officially saying they don't plan to bring back the draft, what's happened is about a year ago in Congress, there was a bill introduced. It was actually a horrible bill that would have required every young man to spend at least 6 months, between 6 months and a year, in the military, including conscientious objectors. They'd have to go to boot camp, and then they could get transferred to some non-combat civilian job.
Are you referring to the bill that was introduced last fall by Representatives Nick Smith, a Republican from Michigan, and Kurt Weldon, a Republican from Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Okay, so basically that bill was called the Universal Military Training and Service Act.
But given the right set of circumstances, a lot of liberal people would buy into, I think, a universal service program, military and alternative service program, that would be coercive and that would apply to women as well as men.
So why do you feel that?
The sense of the times. The feminist movement wants women to be treated equally. All right. Shall that extend to the draft? Como no, of course. And if universal service is proposed instead of selective service, the idea of selective service is not everybody goes. You select out those whom you want and those whom you don't want. And that means that there's going to be a certain inequality by the nature of the thing itself. So make it egalitarian. Everybody goes, men and women. Liberals will go for that. A good many will.
Now, both of you started out the discussion saying that there's a real possibility that the draft will be reinstituted in the U.S. around this impending war against Iraq. What exactly would be required in the congressional process to make that happen?
Congress would have to pass a law to bring back the draft. Actually, the draft law is already in existence. The one part of the draft law that has expired is the power to draft people. Okay, so except for that, the law is in effect, and they've actually got a selective service system in place. They've actually got draft boards in every county throughout the country. At this point, they only meet once a year for training, but they could supposedly be very easily activated and within a matter of weeks or months.
Now, aren't young men and women, or at least young men, required to register somehow at the age of 18,
mm-hmm.
as it is now, according to the law as it stands?
Yes, the law does require that, and you should know that most young men do not register when they are required to, which is a 60-day period around their 18th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
About 90% do register by the time they turn 26, which is when they're no longer eligible for the draft and when they can no longer register. But if you're looking at the people who do what the law requires and register as they turn 18, it's much less than half.
And what are the consequences if you don't do that?
Well, if somebody was prosecuted, the consequences are pretty severe because it's a federal felony with a 5-year fine, 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. But nobody's being prosecuted. Now, obviously, if they started drafting people, that could change. But in fact, what they do is they have linked draft registration with a number of federal benefits. The main one that people know about is federal student aid to go to college. But also, most federal jobs require that you register to get them, and federal job training. And now they've gone to a number of states and tried to get states to impose similar laws. And the most recent version is to link driver's licenses with draft registration, that you can't get a driver's license if you don't register for the draft. So these are the real consequences.
If conscientious objectors are not forced to actually carry a weapon or shoot a weapon, fire a weapon in combat, yet they are actually helping to support the whole system, the military system, would that not be in conflict with their conscience?
It depends on how their consciences are formed. There's two forms of conscientious objection recognized in the law, and one allows a person to be in the military but freed from the obligation of transporting or carrying or being trained with arms. That person would be ordinarily a medic or a chaplain's assistant or something of that sort. The person would serve his time, be released with an honorable discharge, and have all the privileges, rights, benefits of military service. The other classification of conscientious objectors is those who refuse military service and training altogether, and they are assigned to alternative civilian service if their claims are recognized as valid. And those people will serve 2 years or whatever the draft period is at that time, and then they will be released with no benefits and no recognition, whatever, but that's okay too. And then there are those who refuse to cooperate with the system at all and force their ways into the court for refusal of induction into either civilian or military service. That's a small minority.
And that's, of course, not recognized by the law.
Any final thoughts on your part, gentlemen?
Well, I think that everybody who's observed this knows that if there's a strike on Iraq, we're going to have a very, very large, widespread, and rapidly growing movement on the streets in response to it. And it's been underreported so far. Last weekend, there were at least 200,000 people out around the country. Try to find much news of that in the mainstream press. What did the New York Times do with it? Mm-hmm. Underestimated it by a factor of 10 and put it on page 8.
And so people have started to contact you already, Bill, have they?
Oh, yeah. Our phones are going crazy. We get calls for a lot of different things, but we get a lot of calls from people in the military, either people in the reserves who are getting activated or people who are in the military who are facing deployment, saying, hey, this is not what I want to be doing. I think this is wrong. We're also getting all sorts of people calling us saying, I want to get on record as a conscientious objector. I want to know how I can file to be a conscientious objector if the draft starts.
Bill Galvin, Counseling Coordinator for the Center for Conscience and War, and Tom Cornell, Associate Editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper and longtime counselor for draft resistors. As a war with Iraq looms on the horizon in the near future, we thought we'd begin a series today looking at the history behind the first Gulf War. This musical history lesson comes from a new compilation entitled The Fire This Time. We start at the conclusion of the Iran-Iraq War, which left 800,000 soldiers dead and Iraq's economy in shambles.
One day after the ceasefire, Kuwait announced plans to increase oil exports in defiance of OPEC quotas. The price of crude began to slide. In June 1989, they stepped up production again. Iraq was hard hit.
For every fall of a dollar in the price of a barrel of oil, Iraq lost $1 billion in income.
Whilst Iraq was at war, Kuwait had moved into the Rumalia oil field, shifting a border disputed since colonial times. In November, Kuwaiti officials met with the CIA and agreed
to take advantage of the deteriorating economic situation in Iraq, to put pressure on that country's government to delineate our common border. The CIA gave us its view of appropriate means of pressure.
As oil prices collapsed, Kuwait demanded that Iraq repay its wartime debts. In December, the United States invaded Panama, without rebuke from the UN Security Council. The Soviet Empire was in chaos, the global pattern of relationships changing. US War Plan 1002, devised to counter a Russian threat in the Gulf, was updated, and now posed Iraq as the enemy. Early in 1990, General Norman Schwarzkopf briefed Congress.
Middle East oil is the West's lifeblood. It is going to fuel us when the rest of the world has run dry.
Schwarzkopf advocated a permanent U.S. presence in the Gulf. But in the wake of Soviet collapse, there were calls to cut military spending. New enemies had to be found. A white paper was drawn up which identified Iraq and Saddam Hussein as
the optimum contenders to replace the Warsaw Pact.
There was just one problem. According to the U.S. Army War College,
Baghdad should not be expected to deliberately provoke military confrontations with anyone.
U.S. intelligence indicated that Iraq's desire was to reduce the army and repay their debts. But high unemployment made demobilization impossible, inflation on the dinar was 40% and rising, and the price of oil continued to fall. In May 1990, Saddam Hussein protested at Kuwait's continuing overproduction.
Were it possible, we would have endured, but I say that we have reached a point where we can no longer withstand pressure.
The Kuwaitis were dismissive, as an American official recalled.
When the Iraqis came and said, "Can't you do something about it?" the Kuwaitis said, "Sit on it." And they didn't even say it nicely. They were arrogant. They were terrible.
Charles Allen, the CIA's officer for warning, predicted that Iraq would invade Kuwait. His report was shelved. In a diplomatic offensive, Iraq sent envoys to Arab states until Kuwait agreed to a summit. On July 10th, new quotas were settled. On the 11th, Kuwait rejected them and announced plans to further increase production by October. Saddam Hussein's patience was exhausted.
I think he came to believe that Kuwait was overproducing oil, not in its own interest, but because it was goaded into that by the United States in an effort to weaken Iraq.
On July 15th, Iraq wrote to the Arab League and the UN Secretary General, listing their grievances. On the 17th, Saddam Hussein accused Kuwait of economic warfare. On the 18th, troops were sent to the border. Saddam Hussein summoned US Ambassador Glasper and asked her to clarify the American position.
I have direct instructions from the President to seek better relations with Iraq. Our opinion is, you should have the opportunity to rebuild your country, but we have no opinion on Arab-Arab conflicts, like your border disagreement with Kuwait.
As the crisis escalated, King Hussein of Jordan went to Kuwait to try and broker a compromise, to be told,
"We are not going to respond. If they don't like it, let them occupy our territory. We are going to bring in the Americans."
As Iraqi forces moved to the front line, the Assistant Secretary of State was questioned in Congress.
If Iraq, for example, charged across the border into Kuwait, is it correct to say that we do not have a treaty commitment which would oblige us to engage U.S. forces? That is correct.
On the 2nd of August, Iraq invaded.
Lines in the Sand, mixed with the music of the Higher Intelligence Agency. It comes from a new CD compilation entitled The Fire This Time. We'll have more on tomorrow's show. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.